is that when it snows in central London, it just becomes an absolute shit show. Mm. There's no denying it. It's carnage. Like, I had to go to the... I had to go post some stuff. Was it yesterday or the day before? I can't remember. I had to go post some stuff anyway. And it was like, can I not stack it? Let's see if I can not fall over. Because, like, there's one side of the pavement, right where I am, one side of the pavement is all gritted and the other side isn't. And it just happens the side that isn't is the side which I needed to get onto. And I was just like, I've got, like, these trainers which are made by, they're Nike trainers, but they're, it's this collaboration with Gore-Tex, and they're called ACG is the range name, which means like all conditions gear, and they're like legit brilliant in like shit weather, but and they've got really deep tread in them, and even on those I was just skidding around and I saw about three or four people almost stack it, which is but yeah, like where you are, I mean, I bet up in the woods and stuff has been absolutely amazing.
Well, yeah, so the thing is, they're kind of no-go areas at the moment. They're just, they're so muddy. Really? There's so many people walking in the woods now. And there's been so much rain that everything has just turned to slop. The Belgi route has been rerouted. So there's a bit that goes under a railway bridge, which is also known as the Sheep Dip.
Yeah.
They've actually closed that completely now because it's about, well, it's above waist deep of water from there. The rain, but everywhere else is just, it's just slop, it's mud everywhere.
Yeah, I have started recording, by the way. I normally don't, I'll just give you a heads up so you know, but yeah,
everything I can say can be used against me.
Yeah Well, the thing is, like, I always just start recording randomly because I don't like normally, I mean, we've known each other for a long time, so there's never any, I never feel like there's ever going to be that kind of slight awkwardness of like, oh, what. But sometimes with some people, you get this, like, if you tell them that you're, if you tell them you're specifically going to start recording, they then go, oh, okay. But it's definitely, it's obviously different for different people. I always give the pre-warning just to make sure, just so that it's like, oh, fuck, okay. But yeah, I think I know the bit you mean. I think I've seen a few people like post photos of it. It's a proper bit bridge, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's a railway bridge, and it's, yeah, you go under it, and so does all of the water. But it doesn't have anywhere to drain away, so it just sits there. For most of winter, it's kind of impassable.
Yeah, I've never, I've still not done the Belgi route.
Oh, really? Well, you have to come down, and we'll show you around.
Yeah, I need to do it.
Are you still there? I think you're frozen a bit.
I'm still here. Can you see me?
Yeah, I think the internet maybe not be the best.
Yeah, well, the thing is, living in central London, obviously, internet is shite.
Oh, right.
Yeah. genuinely, I think that because everyone's working from home, the quality of the internet where I live has dropped considerably. But... So, you know, this is part of the parcel of the situation we're in anyway, isn't it? It's fucking weird. I get like quite, it's weird because it's nearly almost a year since I started this podcast. And I started it in lockdown in Calpe.
It's a nice place to have lockdown.
Yeah. It was when Spain first went into lockdown.
That's right. And there was trouble getting the flights back, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was pretty horrific, actually, trying to get a flight back. It was like they cancelled all the flights and they did repatriation flights.
Yeah.
And it's like first come, first served, get to the airport and hope, basically. Managed to get relatively lucky and got a flight home, I think, a day earlier than I planned to stay there for. So... But it meant, I think, 3 or 4 days of being told just don't go outside, which was a bit, like, awkward.
Not while you're in a Calpe.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, that would have been just after Atlas Mountain Race. I think I'd come back from Atlas Mountain Race for, like, a week and then went out to Spain for a week. It's what it is, you know. It, as we would actually, in all honesty, you and I would probably be in Morocco right now.
Well, yeah, it's mad that that should have happened. To be honest with you, that being postponed because of my lack of conditioning, shall we say, it was probably, and the lack of opportunity to train, it was probably the best thing for me to move that out to the end of the year. But yeah, it would have been nice to have had something to train for over winter.
Yeah.
I've kind of missed having a real goal for a while. Yeah. Like everything I've tried has been postponed or pushed back or cancelled, or it's been a tough year to try and have something to work towards. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Definitely.
Saying the other day, it feels like there's no real kind of purpose in existence at the moment, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We're just all just, you know, treading water, waiting.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? So, like, people who don't know you, you are, I would always call you Matt Faulkner of TCR fame.
Mm-hmm.
Because how many times have you done it now?
So, I've done the TCR 4 times. And, yeah, I did it in 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019.
2018, was that your best result year?
Yeah, that's when I came second.
That's pretty negative there.
Yeah. I think it always kind of, that's the doorbell. I don't know if you can hear that. Sarah's getting that. 2016, the first one, I came 12th. Then I actually was seventh over the line, but was promoted to fifth in 2017.
Yeah.
You get all sorts of kind of penalties and stuff that, you know, you can't really, a lot of the time, control. So yeah, you never really know the actual result until long after. And then, yeah, 2018 came second. I think you learn a lot after doing a couple of them. Of just kind of getting on with it, you know what I mean?
It is what it is, isn't it? It's riding a bike. Riding a bike and just seeing how long you can ride for each day consistently, effectively, isn't it?
It's just about keeping moving, really.
Yeah.
And keeping fed and watered. You kind of have to look after yourself. Like, as much as it is about keeping moving, it's about being able to keep moving as well.
Hmm.
That makes sense.
I always think, like, with these, I mean, I haven't done half of the kind of ones that you've done. I always feel like it's effectively about keeping, if you imagine a fire, if there's no wood on the fire, the fire goes out, and the human, or a car with petrol, it's a human body's exactly the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
You need to keep these. I always feel like these sort of things become eating contests. Like,
yeah,
it's about getting food, eating it, going again, consistently eating as much as you can. And I know, like, Atlas Mountains last year, and in fact, Silk Road, that was a problem, was being able to get food. It wasn't so bad at Atlas Mountains, but Silk Road, it was a real problem because, you know, we'd be taking camping meals and effectively just trying to survive and cope with those. Find a little shop, spend the equivalent of probably about a tenner, or even less even, and get 4 or 5 carrier bags and then work out how the hell you're going to carry everything. And even in Australia, it was the same thing, is making sure you can continually eat, because the problem with Australia was the length of, or the distance between...
Yeah, the distance between resupply.
Yeah, and that was, you know, I mean, realistically, you'd basically get everything for the day in the morning. You might not come across anywhere until the end of the day, effectively, especially going through like the Nullarbor and stuff.
It's funny, the TCR is really, it's kind of easier in that sense because you're going through Europe and even in the Balkans, and there's different things in different places. Probably the hardest place to find food is France, because they don't have petrol stations like we do. They have, you know, automated ones. Throughout Europe, you have petrol stations, you have, you know, 7-Elevens, you know, grocery stores. There's always, usually, there's always somewhere to find food if you're following kind of a main sort of route, which you kind of have to if you're, you know, trying to follow the fastest way from A to B sort of thing.
Yeah, of course. So you reckon France is probably one of the trickiest ones then?
I struggle in France, always have, because everything's always closed. mainly, like, you know, between in the morning, you know, the boulangerie is open in the morning. That's great. But when you get to the afternoon, things start kind of shutting up. And a lot of the towns, the rural towns, there's nothing really a lot of the time in them. Maybe it's not fair. I mean, there's often, you know, a bar or something that's open, but the supplies aren't really what you're looking for if you're kind of, you want to grab a stash of chocolates and pastries and get on your way. It's sometimes I don't always have the best things on offer. But petrol stations, if you look at, you know, that's the place that's on the side of the road that you can go in and grab stuff in most places. In France, they're predominantly on the, you know, they're automated. You know, there's no shop.
Of course. Just pain in the ass, definitely. What country would you say was like, and all of these TCRs, what's the country that you went through that you kind of got like the best experience of, and you, the one you enjoyed the most?
That's really difficult to say. I mean, the first TCR I did was the one I enjoyed the most because everything was new. Mm-hmm. And the route was pretty special as well. So the first part was through France and it was a big learning curve getting through there. But then into Switzerland and into the mountains, mm-hmm. and basically traversed the Alps. So through the Juras, through the Swiss Alps, and through, you know, into Italy, all the way through, you know, and then popped out just coming into Slovenia. That route was incredible. I mean, I probably did spend most of the time, you know, above 1,500 meters or climbing up to 2,000 plus, you know.
Yeah.
The climbing that you have to do every day to get out of there was nuts. But I'm a big fan of the Balkans. I don't know, Croatia in the first TCR was great, you know, coming along the coast and that. I think it wasn't so nice the last one in 2019, because it's more kind of main roads, and I don't think the drivers are the best in Croatia. They like to see how close they can get to you. It's not a pleasant experience in some places. I think, yeah, from probably the nicest country and the best experience I've had was probably Bosnia. It's a stunning country. Everyone's super friendly. Bosnia is, there's a lot of history there as well. It's quite an intriguing place. But I don't know.
I know how much you enjoyed Romania when you were there, didn't you?
I did not like Romania at all. I mean, so that was in 2017 when you had that heat wave, Lucifer. And that's
2017.
Is it 2017? Yeah.
Bloody hell. Okay, it feels like, I thought that was more recent than this, but yeah, I remember that one well.
Yeah.
Lucifer, yeah.
2017, that was 4 years ago. It's nuts, isn't it? That was my second TCR in TCR number 5. I came out of Hungary. It was super hot. I crossed the border into Romania, immediately started being chased by dogs. And then the roads were pretty busy. There wasn't really much in the way of big motorways. All of the traffic was on the main roads. It was just kind of constant. There was not a lot of room on there. They're kind of, you know, single carriageway, as in there's two lanes. Not the best experience. And then when you try and get away from them, you end up on these back roads, which are just a mess. Then you get chased by more dogs. There were parts which were pretty nice and pretty special, but, you know, the Transfer Garrison mountain climb pass was something. But yeah, I don't know.
I went to Romania in 2000 and I think 14 or 15 and rode across Romania. And the things that I took away from Romania were dogs. There's shit tons of them. They're fucking everywhere. The, as you said, the single carriageways, which are full of lorries.
Yeah.
That come kind of scarily close. And then a lot of the back roads weren't really roads. They were more gravel trails or roads with a hell of a lot of potholes in them, I found.
Yeah.
And when I did it, it was like, I was on a road bike with rim brakes with 23 mil tires. And it definitely wasn't designed for that kind of thing. But the Transfăgărașan Highway was the first time I ever did like a mountain pass, like a proper mountain pass. And it blew my mind. I think a lot of it is because it was the first one. But we stayed, you know, at the very top, there's like a lake. Did you see that? Did you get to the top in the dark?
Yeah. I have this knack of doing these big climbs just in the, as the evening starts.
Yeah.
And then getting to the top in the middle of the night.
So at the very top, there's a lake. And that next to the lake is a hotel. And I stayed in that hotel and woke up the next day, looked out on the lake, descended it in the morning. But had really bad food poisoning. So, yeah, it made it interesting. One of those days where I wasn't sure if I was going to shit myself or not, basically, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
But then the next day, I felt great again. But the thing when I did it is it was about a week's worth of riding because we started basically at one point in like the northwest and just snaked across. The contrasting weather in Romania. Okay. Like one day would be, you know, 30 plus degrees and the next day would be snowstorm. And that's just how it was. But it was, you know, it's a really incredible experience to have done. Especially then at a point when Romania was probably in an interesting point because it'd been kind of brought into the EU. You'd starting to see some of the funding coming through from the European Union with the roads getting better. But it was definitely, you know, the contrast between like the villages. One village would be, you know, it might feel like a proper town, and then the next one would feel like you're proper in the middle of nowhere, you know, horse-drawn carriage, that kind of thing. I remember stopped in one village and this kid he'd got a little bike and his brakes weren't working. And I had some spares on me, so I just fixed one of the brakes. And he was like absolutely mind blown by it. So me and my mate then got invited into his house to have a coffee with his parents, and it was like coffee boiled in just like a saucepan and then poured into like plastic, like those like plastic polystyrene cups.
Yeah.
And they just disintegrate because of the heat and the polystyrene, and you're holding it, you're like, fuck, this thing's so hot. Yeah, it was a pretty incredible experience, Romania. I definitely got much better memories of it than you, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I think because I was racing through it, the first night I spent there was in an abandoned car park. An abandoned petrol station car park, a forecourt, basically. And it was freezing cold at night. Like I said, there was the heat wave. So in the day, it would get up to 45 degrees. Through the day. Petrol stations were good in Romania. There was a lot of good supplies, which is always good. Bit of variety, lots of ice creams.
Perfect for a heat wave.
Well, it's key, really.
Yeah.
Whether there's heat wave or not. But the whole time I was there, it was just so hot. Like I remember after Transfăgărașan, descending down, I managed to find a really friendly bike shop who sorted me out with a bunch of spare tubes. But yeah, just the next day was just having to stop every 30 minutes to get cool water because my, you know, it'd just be boiling hot water in my water bottles. So
yeah.
That was just hard. And I'm sure if the weather was a bit more clement and I wasn't in such a hurry to get across the country, it would have been, I've been able to stop and enjoy it a bit more. And but yeah.
What would you say is like some of the worst places you've slept then?
Worst places I've slept. That forecourt was a good one. The first time I bivvied, the first TCR, I found two of the worst places. One was a freshly cut straw field. So basically it's like sleeping on a bed of nails. Yeah. Don't do that. A valley in a field, which got so cold at night. That was just, it was just stupid. Mm. I've been pretty good with bivvying and, you know, finding kind of relatively good places. Mostly it's just bus stops and kind of just places just out of the way. I don't know. I tend to find hotels more. Having that little bit of comfort and being able to have a clean is pretty key when you're doing long distance runs.
Completely agree. That's one of the things that I found quite tough in Kyrgyzstan and Romania, is that you don't get that opportunity effectively. I say I found it tough. You kind of just accept it, but you kind of get used to the fact that you do stink, you're salty and everything like that. But a hotel, even if it's a bed for one night where you can like wash your kit and yourself, is kind of worth its weight in gold, because it just instantly like refreshes you the next day. It's like a psychological thing, isn't it? I think it's been noticeable more recently in TCR, more people have been doing that, and like bivvying is probably like the resort if you need to.
Well, I mean, so the TCR is intended to be accessible. You don't need a fortune to travel across Europe in theory. And, you know, you can take enough kit with you and be comfortable and bivvy. You know, you don't have to spend a fortune on hotels. If you're racing at the pointy end, you kind of need it a bit to be able to be staying sharp and fresh.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, it's a balance, I find. Like I would do, you know, one night hotel, one night bivvy, or two night bivvy, depending on, you know, if I'm doing a couple of night, you know, I want to get somewhere fast, so I'll, you know, maybe stop at a bus stop for an hour or something like that. But yeah, it does depend. You have to kind of, you know, look after yourself, not just, you know, your food and your water, and you've got to manage your sleep. Got to get good sleep and manage your mind state as well. After that,
I mean, if your head's not in the game, that's when mistakes happen, potentially quite dangerous mistakes as well. And accidents can happen as well. The year that you came second could be a bit of an example of that, maybe, eh?
Yeah.
Bit of a slip at the end.
Well, I mean, it's funny that is one of those examples that I have of what I see as this kind of ups and downs of ultra racing. So you always have this kind of roller coaster of how things are going, usually.
Yeah.
Like if you're at a low point and, you know, you're like, oh, I'm so tired, you know, I always know that it's going to come back up again. You know, you're always going to find yourself on the going up again. But if you're really happy and you're like, this is great, this is awesome, watch out.
Yeah.
Thing is about to come and hit you. I the year before that one, I got pipped at the top. I'd stopped to speak to the race photographer.
Yeah.
Nelson Trees, who runs the Silk Road and Atlas Mountain Race. He just passed me as I was chatting. And beat me to sixth place. So, but I mean, I think with penalties and time penalties and stuff, I actually got promoted above him anyway. So I was like, I didn't need a finish. But I came over the top of the mountain in Meteora in 2018. And I was like, oh, I've done it. That was easy. I was like, you know, that last climb, I just ridden pretty much straight from Bosnia, with maybe 10 minutes at the side of the road snoozing. And I was like, yeah, I've done it. I've got over that last climb. And I was just wheeling down and I was like, this is good. I'm feeling good. And then I was like, what's that in the road? And then bang, like this rock caused a double flat. And I'd been riding through a thunderstorm a couple hours before, and my saddlebag had soaked up a bit of water. So a bit heavier than it should have been.
Yeah.
And I got this horrendous speed wobble with two flat tires. And there's nothing I could do other than just ditch it. Crash into a big pile of gravel. it was messy.
At the end of the day, you were okay.
I mean, I've got a few scars still, and a few cuts. I had a few cuts. That's all it was.
Yeah.
I changed the two tubes, constantly looking over my shoulder.
Because at that point, the race for second place was very much on, wasn't it?
Yeah. So Bjorn Leonard was probably about 30 minutes to an hour behind me. Yeah. I had no idea where he was. I could hear some dogs barking. I was like, uh-oh, that means there's someone coming. I was a bit paranoid by then. Just kind of, you know, I had a bit of an adrenaline shock from the crash, and I changed my tires. Quite a bit of blood, not going to lie. Managed to change the tires. I completely forgot that I had a dynamo plugged into my front wheel, and so pulled the connector off that. I was like, oh no. And then I was wheeling down the mountain with half inflated tires and a head torch because my dynamo light was unplugged. And I got there. It was only, 10 kilometers or so from the finish downhill. But
still adds that element of stress though, eh?
Yeah, I think it made probably more people at home more stressed than I was.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah. Because I remember I was following that one very intently, and loads of us were like, what the fuck's happened? Like, he stopped. Whereas he stopped. Like, and it was the fact that it was like so close to the end, but not at the end that you'd stopped. That's what I think it was like, what the fuck's happened? But
yeah,
I mean, that was mega. It was very, very inspiring to follow, really, really inspiring to follow. And I think a lot of us in the, like, our area were quite, really inspired to have seen it and to quite frankly know who you are and to know how, as a very humble man that you are, to have done that year especially. It was really incredible. Everyone was proper behind you for it. I think there was a lot of praise thrown your way, rightly so, I think, that year especially, and every year, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, I have to say that the support you get on these things, it's incredible. It really helps. Mm. You can be, on your own in the middle of, Romania or Bosnia or Serbia or whatever, and you get a little flash, you're doing awesome on your screen, on your phone. And it's like, that's an extra, 10 watts, 20 watts, whatever. Sometimes you can probably burn a bit more energy than you had, and it comes back to bite you. But no, it really does help. Like, gives you a big lift at times to know that there's so many people kind of, watching out for you and giving you encouragement, that sort of thing.
That's where the tracker is so useful, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really allows people to follow into the races and the people racing as well. I think having the trackers make a massive difference to as a spectator, as such, on all of these kind of ultra distance races. It allows you to really buy into certain people.
Yeah, I think dot watching is wonderful. It's a great sport. It's kind of how I started ultra, really, was following dots on, I think it was on the Trans Am and also the TCR before. I started getting a little bit hooked into it. But it's a great way to follow a race. It's like you can kind of get your own view of what's going on. You have to do the digging in. So yes, you've got a dot on the screen, but then you zoom into the map and you see what's around. And it's like, it's a McDonald's, or it's the service station. Or, you know, you can see someone is stopped in one place. You can panic for a bit because, oh, why would they stop there? But then the dot updates and it's, you know, 10 miles down the road, you know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. You can kind of get carried away with looking at a dot.
So would you say that's how, as you just said, that's kind of what got you into doing some of the ultra distance stuff?
I mean, it kind of fascinated me a bit, you know, where these people were going and seeing these races. I don't know how I got into this. I'm really not sure. Like I started doing a few challenges, a few kind of A to B rides, and I kind of wanted to do something more. I've always wanted to travel across Europe and tour across Europe on a bike. Mm. But I never really thought it was possible until I saw, you know, the TCR and some of these other guys doing it. But the time that they did it as well, it's like, well, if you want to travel across Europe, you want to take, what, a couple of months off or a summer off or something like that. No, this is 2 weeks, you know. I was like, well, you know, I could take 2 weeks off work. I could probably manage that. Give it a go, see what happens, you know. It's a crazy way to be able to, you know, to actually get and do this. And like I said, it was another kind of challenge, another kind of level that I wanted to see what I could do. And it was strange how it sort of all came about. Someone suggested, you know, why didn't you do this? I'm like, that's crazy. And then I was like, okay, give it a go, put an entry in, see what happens. I don't think I was terribly serious when I did my first application for the TCR. It was more like, well, I'll give it a go, see what they say. But once you kind of apply, you kind of start thinking that the ways that you need to think for long distance and ultra. Kind of got hooked.
I mean, you would, I know I've known you for a long time, and you would never confess that you were maybe not the most sporty person when you were younger, shall we say?
No, I mean, when I grew up, I had a bicycle. I was never really into sports, per se. Did the usual stuff at school, bit of rugby, bit of cross country running, bit of football. But never athletic. I used to do quite a bit of scuba diving, which kept me fit.
That's really cool. Did not know that.
Yeah, I used to actually be an instructor in West Wales when I was 18, 19.
So where do you scuba dive in Wales?
Beautiful scuba diving in Wales. So I'm from St. David's in West Wales, and it's a peninsula. There's loads of shipwrecks, loads of reefs, loads of places to scuba dive. It's really actually quite spectacular. It's not the Red Sea, or, you know, it's British seas. Visibility can be pretty temperamental sometimes, you know, down to 1 or 2 meters. But in the summer, when you get a good, you know, 6-7 meter day, it's wonderful. There's so much to see down there. It's another world. Where was I going with that?
You were saying about you were scuba diving, and then we're talking about you not being, you know, just doing the usual kind of things as a kid, like cross country, a bit rugby, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, after I kind of left St. David's, I came to London to go to Australia for a year, traveling, backpacking. I guess that maybe helped with my kind of ability to sort of, you know, go off on a bike. But that was just really just dossing around for a year and drinking and enjoying life, as it were. But when I came back from there, I was, you know, desk-bound in London with not a lot of sport going on. Didn't really do much until I think it was 2011, when I went on a stag weekend with a friend, and one of the activities was mountain biking. And I remember getting on this bike. I mean, I had a horrendous hangover. And then we had been surfing. It was February. It was actually 10 years ago. In February. And we went surfing in the morning, then went mountain biking. I had been quite ill through the morning. And I'm sure that's possibly
Through alcohol?
Sorry?
From the alcohol?
No. I got a bit seasick. No, it was definitely alcohol. I remember trying to ride this mountain bike up this hill, and I just couldn't do it. Everyone else was kind of, you know, off they went. And I was like, this is not good. I used to do this all the time. I used to ride my bike to the dive center, and, you know, every day. And I couldn't ride up a hill. So after that, I kind of bought a hybrid, did a bit of riding my bike locally, and then ultimately sold my car and started commuting to work by bike after that. And then the rest is kind of history. I started, just commuting every day. I think that's been the biggest thing for me for cycling, is being able to commute to work.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with since lockdown, is not having that daily 2 hours of exercise. It's kind of how it all started.
It makes a huge difference, doesn't it? Like, because you were commuting from, you know, Surrey into central London, basically, as well.
Yeah.
It's a long ride, but also actually a very, I think, quite a nice ride as well. You're coming through the Richmond Park as well in the morning. So it's actually quite a nice way to start your day and then also to end your day.
Yeah.
But losing that in lockdown, I think for a lot of people has been really tough. Like, I mean, I could sit on a turbo train all day long. I don't know how, but it doesn't faze me that much. But I know a lot of people can't stand that. Like, and I completely get it. I completely understand that. Like, I think for me, it's just become a means to an end, because if I'm riding a TT bike, I need to get out of London to ride a TT bike. Because you can't do any like structured training on a TT bike in central London, really, unless you go to the parks, and it's still not easy in the parks.
No.
So for my own, like, I guess, like, time management, I just accept that I'm doing it indoors. So like, it gives me a lot of opportunity to get used to the position, but it's not necessarily enjoyable. It's just a means to an end. It's a way of getting training sessions done. It's not like I particularly enjoy riding my bike that way. It's just is what it is. And I think a lot of people probably can sympathize as well with the fact that the last near enough a year now, we've been pretty limited on the amount of sort of outdoor riding and exploring we can do. And, you know, when was the last time you went into your office?
So I think I maybe nipped in June to pick up some stuff, but I've not been in there. So the last time I was actually working at the office was in March the 4th last year.
Yeah.
But that was because I actually went to visit our offices in Arizona.
Yeah, I remember.
After that. And as I was there, I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. And then Trump basically banned international travel, and I was like, you know what, I need to go home. So cut that short a week, and then straight into lockdown. So
yeah, I remember when you went out there as well, actually. But yeah, it's strange how it's altered travel so much like that. Losing a commute, which is something that so many people found, I'm certain hundreds of thousands of people have found something so beneficial to their daily you know, working day. It has been tricky for a lot of people to manage. That's part, like, I get on the turbo and train in the mornings, because it just sets up the whole day and I'm not thinking about it for the rest of the day. But equally, when I was commuting, it was like, I would, you know, commute to work, felt like I was ready for a good day of work, because I always felt like it started the day really nicely. And then come home, if I needed to train, I'd train afterwards. So I was probably, you know, I'd have been doing more riding, but maybe not so structured, so to speak. But
yeah,
It'd be interesting to see what happens in the future. Like if the whole, if this working from home thing is something that becomes the norm.
Yeah. So
I think for some businesses it will be.
Yeah, my company's got a bit of a strategy around that. For they've got a few, they're changing, they're adapting their offices. So yeah, the focus is going to be less office space, mainly to save money, but it's just, you know, it's a bit more practical, I think. But I think personally, I'm going to request a desk because I need to be able to leave home and go to work. I need that separation of this is work and this is home. And yes, to have the commute as well. That's key for me. I really struggle. I mean, I think when the lockdown first came in, I did a few kind of early morning rides before work. I started doing some Belgies actually in the morning before work. It was good fun. I kind of resurrected a couple of old bikes, put some off-road tires on and went around in the woods for a couple hours in the morning.
Yeah.
But it's as the time's gone on, it's just been harder to get that motivation to get up and do that before work. I need to be able to go somewhere. I need to have a purpose for the ride, if you know what I mean.
Forced motivation, isn't it?
Otherwise, sorry?
It's like forced motivation.
Yeah. It's purpose, you know, having that need to get from A to B. Trains, I've never been a fan of squishing into a packed train in the morning and then standing for 2 hours and paying, you know, 20 quid a day for the privilege. Cycling is just much better option for me for getting to work. But
yeah, I'm with you. I can't stand trains or most forms of public transport, but trains are definitely the ones that I would choose the least. And I mean, it's very, very noticeable that the trains are way more quiet now. Same with, buses and everything like that at the moment, which it is what it is at the end of the day. One thing I wanted to ask is, I wanted to ask you to chuck in what you would say are a few like good tips for people who want to look at doing some of these ultra distance races.
So I think there's kind of a handful of things that you kind of need to be sure that you get right. The first thing is your kit. And to be honest with you, it doesn't really matter what kit you have. As in, you need to have enough kit to be prepared for everything. But the key thing with the equipment that you take with you is you need to know how to use it. You need to know how to repair it. You need to have trained with it. You need to have practiced with it. So that's really, you know, one of the biggest things is, you know, some people take, you know, brand new stuff out to these events and stuff goes wrong and not having the experience with it, you know, like a bivvy or a tent or something like that. Not having the experience with it, it means it's going to cost you time. It might even cost you your race if you don't know how to fix it or you don't know how to use it or something goes wrong with it. Or if it's not good enough for what you need.
Yeah.
But getting your kit right and knowing your kit and testing your kit is probably one of the biggest things. Because then you're prepared for stuff and that's really, you know, the heart of what you need to be doing for an ultra race is preparation and knowing your kit and knowing how to use it. I think fitness is always important. I don't know. I've been lucky with commuting and that was my kind of base and being able to train a couple hours a day has been key for me to be able to, you know, do ultra racing. But I don't think you need to be super fit to do an ultra distance race. It helps with recovery and that sort of thing. Having a good sort of, you know, training plan and understanding your fitness is good. Again, really for your route and your kind of schedule and how you then use that route. So, you know, breaking it down into manageable chunks, you know, like 200 kilometers a day sort of thing would be a good bit of advice. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's riding your bike at the end of the day. The rest is just kind of planning and keeping moving.
Yeah. So a big part of it, I think very clearly, is preparation is key, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
as you say, know your kit, know your bike, train with what you're going to take. I'd also say, like, what I always found useful is training with the bike fully weighted and loaded up is always quite good, because then you understand how it feels climbing, descending, whatever it is like that. You really kind of get a good feel of it. But yeah, the big thing is, as you say, is preparation, prepping it as much as you can, prepping the routes, prepping everything you can in advance, so that you're kind of, to any surprise, you can deal with it the best way possible.
Yeah. And I think that that's the key as well, is, you know, if you can put yourself in a situation that you might experience on the race, like sleeping, you know, bivvying outdoors, or, you know, doing a couple of multi-day rides where you will get tired and you will get sore, you'll get pain. And, you know, if you can train that, you can do that before the race, you can then learn how your body kind of reacts to this sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
You can then understand that that little niggle is actually, that's nothing to worry about, that just means I need to stretch. Then if you take away those worries and those concerns when you're in the race, it makes everything just that little bit smoother. And
so what are your fit, I mean, fingers crossed we can, what are your kind of race goals for this year? Or it doesn't even have to be race goals, like just general goals for this year. Is there anything that, apart from Atlas Mountains, like we've already sort of briefly covered, is there anything you've got in mind?
So I'm going to go back to Italy and do the Italy Divide, hopefully. That's been scheduled to July.
July, okay.
I'm a huge fan of riding my bike through Italy. There's lots of things to, well, it's going to be warm, and hopefully there won't be any mud this year. the last one was pretty rough for mud and well, snow.
Yeah.
Say my internet connection is unstable. It's gone now.
Oh, I can hear you.
Yeah. Okay. Did it in 2018 and 2019. The first year I did it on my Curve Belgi Spirit.
You did it on your road bike, basically, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, I had a lot of fun pushing the bike to its limits and up most of the climbs. That was a lot of fun. Going to go back to Italy this year. Seeing the Tuscan roads in the summer would be pretty good. And having a bit more daylight as well, I think, would be nice.
Yeah.
In the middle of summer. Ride a bit longer and that sort of thing. Just summer in Tuscany. Wow. How good would that be?
I'd be heaven, mate. I'm very envious.
But yeah, then after that, I've got the Badlands for this year, I think, which is in September.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of starts in the Sierra Nevadas in Granada. And it's about 700K, I think.
Yeah.
Off-road gravel race through the Badlands of Spain. That caught my imagination as soon as it was announced. I couldn't get there last year for the rescheduled date, but I really wanted to go back and do that. That one looks good. And then, yeah, the Atlas Mountain Race. I just want to do these events. I don't really have much desire to be at the pointy end. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I've got enough time to be fit enough and ready for that, but yeah,
it's for the experience at the end of the day, isn't it, as well? It equally is valid to do these kind of events. For me, slightly unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to make Atlas Mountains this year, because the new days are the days when the Trans-Pyrenees is. So I had planned to do Trans-Pyrenees in 2020. That got rescheduled to, obviously, to 2021. And the Atlas Mountain race got moved to the, I think it crosses over by like 2 or 3 days, realistically.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's not possible to do both. So I messaged.
It's not possible to do both and have any sort of enjoyment on them. You kind of want to be fit and strong, ready for them.
Yeah, so anyway, I messaged Nelson, and I've rescheduled my my Atlas Mountain race entry to 2022. But same Badlands I'd entered to do it last year. The proposed move dates were the same times that I was doing my 107 TDF ride. So I transferred that entry to this year as well, which the same thing, like it, I just was blown away by how beautiful it was. It looks incredible.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the Gorath Desert. And
yeah, it looks
out there. So.
That race for me, that probably suits me more than any of the other ones because it's the gravel. You know, I will never say I'm amazing off-road. I'm not. I'm all right. Like, don't get me wrong. But I've freaking crashed out of Atlas Mountains race and Silk Road Mountain race. That says quite, you know, admittedly, Silk Road was probably out of my control because that was due to hydraulic brake failing.
Yeah.
And then basically deciding when I got to a checkpoint, I was like, it's too dangerous to continue. That's what was my take on it, Silk Road. I had one brake. Atlas Mountains was more of a mistake on my part where I just wiped out and crashed. And I was dealing with a herniated disc, which got considerably worse after I crashed.
Yeah.
And then when I got to the checkpoint, I couldn't really stand up properly. I kind of thought maybe this is a good reason to stop.
Yeah.
And then when I was checking over the bike and I realized that I bent the frame, I think that kind of sealed the deal on that one.
This yeah.
The frame, bent the rear triangle on it because I was trying to get the rear wheel out because I'd cracked the rear wheel. Yeah, so I cracked it that way around the rim. And I didn't know that I'd done it. So literally, if that's the rim profile, it cracked around the shape of the profile. I didn't realize I'd done it. And another guy who had scratched pointed it out to me and was like, oh, do you know your rear wheel's got a massive like crack in it? I was like, oh, shit, that's not good. So I was like, I was asking around to anyone else that scratched. Has anyone got like a spare? If anyone that's pulled out, can I take your wheel? I'll pull out the race just to be able to finish. Mm-hmm. And a guy offered and took my wheel out and then went to put this other wheel in and couldn't get it in because the rear triangle had bent. So, you know, I'm not going to say I'm the best at riding off road, but
designed.
Yeah, it's all learning at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think Badlands probably suits me better because it's definitely not as technical, I'd say, as from what I've seen as Atlas Mountains.
Yeah, I think there may be a couple of places which. Nice little surprises.
Oh, of course.
Which is always great off road, is you've got to have those little kind of gems hidden away waiting for you.
I think there'll be fewer of them than there was in Morocco, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the bits that always stands out for me at Atlas Mountains was climbing up a sewer, pretty much, with, do you know John Woodruff?
I know the name. I don't think I met him.
It was me and John Woodruff basically climbing up this pretty much an old sewer out of a valley. And both of us just like, for fuck's sake, this is fucking shit. Because it stunk of shit. It was on the route. It was actually on the route. We weren't off route or anything, but we were just like, John's quite a vocal person, shall we say, when things disgruntle him. And he's... got a very, very American accent. So him getting angry is quite funny. I found it funny at the time anyway. But yeah, you're just like pushing your bike up and just going, fucking hell, this is pretty, pretty grim. But I've got a place in GB Giro as well. And I'm now debating whether I think that is a mountain bike race or a gravel bike race. I'm probably veering towards a mountain bike.
Yeah, it sounds like it is a mountain bike race. It sounds like one of those things you could probably get away with a gravel bike.
It's going to be shit.
But yeah, it'll be a lot harder.
Yeah, that's where my head was at. For Atlas Mountains, I'd go back on a mountain bike, personally.
Everyone I've spoken to said it's a mountain bike race.
Yeah,
you can get round on a gravel bike, but it's a bit too hard for a. You need front suspension, I believe.
Yeah, I had Lau forks last year, which helped, but they're an interesting idea. I think it's a very clever design. It's great on like washboard sort of surfaces, things like that. Mm. But really gnarly off-road stuff, I actually think it probably compromises the bike a bit, personally.
Okay.
Because the wheel's not already on a locked central like pivot point. So potentially the front of the bike feels quite loose and sketchy as well.
I've heard that.
Yeah. But like anything that's like washboardy or anything like that, they're incredible. They're fantastic on that sort of stuff. When I did Silk Road, Rob Quirk had Lau forks on his bike, and there's a lot of washboard surfaces in Silk Road, and he's absolutely fine. Me, on contrast, on the solid forks, was just like the whole time. But yeah, I would say like for Atlas Mountains, like front suspension would be a really big help in that race. You could do it on a locked fork, but the end of the day, like volume in air in your tires is going to make a huge difference as well. I was riding 33s, I think, or 35s. Yeah.
30 35. What?
I think I was riding 35s. Yeah.
Basically road tires.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the frame didn't have much. On the front, I could have got larger, but the rear, I couldn't get much more than, I think, a 35 in the frame. So that was, I think I put a 38 in the end on the front and a 35 on the rear, I think it was. The bike I was riding was a prototype, so it was loads of like bits that were just not quite refined, but it's helped to refine that bike even more, which is good. But yeah, I mean, if you had 650s with like a freaking, 2-inch tire or something, it'd be pretty good, definitely. That'd really help, I would say.
Yeah,
on that race.
Now I've got 2.2 650s on my Kevin, which I think is pretty versatile. It's great fun in the Surrey Hills and in the mountain bike trail around Peas Lake, but even there, I can see the benefit of having suspension on top of having the volume.
Yeah, definitely. What are you thinking you're going to use for Atlas Mountains then?
I haven't really decided. I'd love to get a new bike to do it.
Yeah.
And I've got some ideas for a mountain bike, but I don't know. Everything is telling me to get a mountain bike to do it, without a doubt. But if I can't afford that, or, I don't get any other opportunity, I will take Kevin.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin's going to be definitely a very, very good option.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good platform for doing that with the volume you can get. But we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. So how I always like wrap up podcasts, and I don't think I pre-warned you, I can't remember if I did or not, is I always ask for like five, and it is five for a reason, five tips or hacks or anything, really. Other examples are things like cooking techniques, bike maintenance techniques, pretty much anything and everything. And I asked for five because I think that three is really easy. The fourth one is pretty good, and the fifth one's normally very, very good. So there's no pressure or anything, mate.
Five tips or hacks for ultra-distance cycling.
It could be for anything. It could be anything you want. I'll take my hat off that I have obviously stumped you.
I did have loads, but I've forgotten everything now. tips or hacks.
You can start with one and then they just sort of start to roll off, mate. That's how it works. Normally when someone's got one, they're like, oh, actually, and this and this and this.
Well, top tip, if your frame has the seat pole, seat tube, bottle cage holders quite high up, is to get something to lower them, lower the bottle cage. That is key to be able to fit a frame bag in. That's really, really valuable. So you can get more water in, so you can ride for longer. And yeah, making more use of the frame, space on the frame.
Wolf tooth, a special thing, don't they, which allows you to drop them down.
Yeah, so I think there's a wolf tooth one. I think originally I had a DI2 battery holder. So the old DI2 batteries used to be external, and you could attach that to the bottle cage and kind of stagger it with the adapter. But the one I had on the first TCR, that snapped going over cobblestones in Greece, I think. On the way to Turkey, and yeah, some cable ties. Always take cable ties with you.
There you go. Told you. There you go.
That saved the bottle cage. That was very, very, very good. One of the things I always use is tape wrapped around the pump. So whether it's a frame pump or a hand pump, so you can wrap around some insulation tape or even Gorilla tape or something like that, any tape that you might need on the road is to wrap that around. And that's really, really good tip. So you've always got something that you can just tape it up.
Look, you've done three already, mate.
Yeah.
Is it easy?
What else is there? Three, four.
God, I could give you a fourth one, which you would agree with straight away, which is ice cream is the best recovery food.
Yes, I mean, without a doubt. It's the best pick-me-up as well. So if you are feeling low and you want to get some food in you, start with a Magnum ice cream or something. Any ice cream is great. It's got all the good stuff. It's sweet, it's cold, it's refreshing, even in the winter.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you.
And in fact, and in fact, in the winter, ice cream is even better because it doesn't melt so fast. So you can keep that for a little longer without having to worry about it melting. Is that a fifth tip? I don't know. I've got a fifth one.
Okay.
And that is calypsos, or kind of the tube ice lollies. They have several purposes. So there's the two things you can do with a calypso. Well, three. You can actually just eat it. That's one. That's one of them. But the other one is if it's really hot, is you can put a calypso down the back of your neck.
Yeah.
And that keeps your neck cool. That's good. And then after 30 minutes, if it's a really hot day, you can take that and just drink it. It's lovely. But you can also just put that in your bidon. With a bit of water, so then you it kind of keeps your water cool and also is nice and sweet and tasty and nice.
See, I told you could do five very easily, and I think the Calypso one is probably the winner of all of them. And when you were younger, do you remember there was Ribena ones?
Ribena Calypsos? I don't remember that.
They were, when I was a kid, they were the one, was Ribena ones. Because you could always get orange ones, or there was always orange ones, and I think like a pink one.
A lemon one,
yeah. But there was proper Ribena branded ones as well. And that was my go-to as a kid, was Ribena branded ones. Because I just really like Ribena. I've got like some nostalgic thing with it as a kid. Like, it's the thing that your parents would give you when you're like, you're not very well. I don't understand why, but hot Ribena was always the thing I used to get given as a kid.
Yeah.
It's probably
done. I was always a big fan as a kid of lemon and orange sparkle lollies. They were like 15p. And it's just like it's like a calypso on a stick, basically.
Yeah. It's funny how for so much of like these ultra distance stuff, you go to nostalgic kid food, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
I 100%, that's what I end up doing is I'm like, in Australia, I think it was at the end of almost every single day, it was like chocolate milk, ice cream. That's the end of my ride. What's wrong with that? It's a great way to finish your day, isn't it?
But it's got all of the food groups that you need, your body needs to kind of pick itself back up again. I mean, maybe you need some more vitamins and minerals in there, but you know, you've got your carbs and your proteins and your sugars. So
yeah, exactly. That's the priorities, obviously, at the end of a long day of riding across the desert, isn't it?
100%.
Might struggle a bit with getting some ice cream in Morocco, I'll be honest with you. But I'll tell you what you can get out there. Bread. Lots of bread.
Yeah.
Lots of omelettes. And when I was there, one of the shops that I found, and I'm vegetarian, so it's not, actually it's quite easy in Morocco, I found. It's quite hard in Silk, in Kyrgyzstan, but it was basically impossible in Kyrgyzstan because you didn't really know what you were buying half the time. But in Morocco, it's quite easy. But loads of people would buy tin sardines. I don't eat sardines, but I get it. There's a great bit of food there.
Salty as well.
Salty, bit of protein in it. Mm. It's got cod liver, well, not cod liver oil, but it's got fish oil in it. You know, there's lots of good in that. What I found in the shop where everyone was buying sardines was, you know, like the cheese triangles?
Dairily.
Dairily. They weren't Dairily, though. They were Spider-Man, but the Spider-Man branded ones. I could have said your photo later. They.
You know, I remember seeing some pictures of that from the race.
Spider-Man branded cheese. Yeah, that was pretty good. And I remember the shop that I found that at was, I think it was on the way to, you go to this waterfall, and it was on the way to this waterfall. Mm-hmm. There was a guy that like protects the waterfall, and he just sits there and offers you tea, and he's, to be honest, he's high as a kite. But I can't think of his name now. Omar, I think, is his name. And he's the guardian of the waterfall and lives at the waterfall. And it was before getting to Omar, and I was pretty cooked. It has been hot. And got to this little shop, bought the cheese, bought some bread, because the bread's really nice, but it goes stale very quickly. It's got no preservatives in it or anything.
Yeah.
But also my chain on my bike, I'd ran out of, this is prime mistake, I'd ran out of like lube because it's so dusty and sandy.
Yeah.
So I bought some olive oil. Worked great. Absolutely fantastic for lubing a chain. So I was having my bread, my cheese, and my olive oil, and then put a bit of oil on the bike as well. It's great. Lovely little experience. Got a bottle of Coke as well in that shop I did. I really, really splashed out that day.
Good haul.
Yeah. And actually, I'm not going to say the next thing. I'll tell you it off air because it's very rude. So on that note, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Matt. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. One of the nicest men in the world. One of the nicest man in the world. Yeah, that does sound right, doesn't it? I think that's right.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with this year. Good luck with the races. Hopefully they can go ahead.
Thanks, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.